adequate phrase arose in my mind at that precise moment to fully describe this experience, and it was this: I am in the presence of God energy. The next thing I remember, waking, lying face down in the mud beside the river, alone and naked, the ropes still loosely attached to my wrists. It was dawn, light filtering through the forest canopy. I rose and staggered back toward the village, shivering and drained, but still carried and filled by the joyous wonder I had experienced. The shaman welcomed me by the village's central fire, smiling, and they wrapped me with a blanket, set me down in the shaman's hut, and gently let me sip from a bowl of water, and fed me some kind of bland root paste. I felt as weak as a foundling, and unable to speak. The shaman sat down beside me and leaned in, and repeated the same phrase to me more than a few times, which roughly translated, I heard as, "You are reborn into a new world."
Archivist's note. As a result of provocative material like this, Jacoby's book was fiercely attacked by the American medical establishment as lacking scientific rigor, but he rejected their criticism on the basis that their traditional methods and standards were outmoded. "Scientific objectivity is one of our most deeply held and crippling illusions," he wrote. He also claimed that all true spiritual insights and experiences were by necessity profoundly disrupting and deeply personal to the individual and therefore entirely subjective. For some visionary sociologists and anthropologists, and a big percentage of the then-emerging New Age culture, Jacoby's work became one of the signature works for a new way of comprehending human psychological evolution, and it enjoys cult status to this day.
4. Not with me. I tried to plow my way through his magnum opus, but it reads like an encyclopedia of meandering gibberish. Though I'll concede it would probably make a lot more sense if you were on drugs. TP.
Jacoby claimed that one of the main reasons he returned to his hometown was to continue his studies with Native American tribes in the region, along with the need to care for his older brother Robert, the veteran reporter for the Post, who by this time had been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. But accepting a conventional job with a hospital, as can be seen in this evaluation of Nadine, was no guarantee that Jacoby's methods would be any less unusual.
Dr. Lawrence Jacoby, 11/29/87, 4:30 p.m. Nadine Gertz Hurley, married. Date of birth, January 25th, 1950. Female, 37. 5'6", 112 pounds. Wow. Patient is really whacked out, poor thing. I mean, she is hip-deep in this shit. Husband shot out her left eye a couple of weeks ago. Hunting accident, or at least that's their story about it. And it doesn't ring altogether true, so there's plenty of room for skepticism once you get past the particulars. Husband's the sturdy, stolid, patriarchal type. Classic blue-collar, strong, silent, upstanding Vietnam vet. But non-combatant, not to suggest for a second that he shot her on purpose, but someone made a choice here. And my money's on Nadine. She's a thwarted creative with severe blockages and neurotic adaptations. No doubt from family history, which I will try and take some time to inventory. Working hypothesis, the left eye is wired to the right side of the brain. So in the event a choice was made, patient has chosen to shut down the optic pathway to her intuitive side. One possible interpretation would be that she was sensing something going on around her that she didn't want to see. The injury will likely prompt a period of intense suffering, as it seems she was already predominantly left brain dominant. And the right side is now literally flying blind. Since we almost know there's no such thing as an accident, and there's a positive side to every negative choice, let's dance with the idea that perhaps she willed the loss of her eye to stimulate internal growth in her area of greatest deficit. We all choose our fate, even if, well, to quote Beadle Paul with St. Paul, the road to Damascus is long and winding. But if she can be led to embrace what she's unconsciously chosen for herself, maybe she's got a chance. The family has an extensive file here at the hospital. Aha! Mother was diagnosed manic depressive at this very institution about 10 years ago and shipped off for state psychiatric care. Dad signed the papers. She was sent to a former fort built in 1871, by the way, that had been converted to a mental ward, where she underwent shock treatment, straitjackets and hydrotherapy, which involved pounding subjects with cold water from pressurized hoses. For a more primitive means of treating this illness, you'd have to refer back to the Victorians and Bedlam. Astonishing. It gets worse. The daughter was herself admitted for comprehensive treatment for depression about 2 months after Mom was sent to the snake pit. Nadine froze in school one day, standing at her locker, couldn't move. They found her locked in place between classes and had to carry her like a mannequin to the nurse's office. Not a full break. It turned out but a debilitating one requiring 6 weeks of treatment, including such classics as sleep and art therapy and a soupçon of Thorazine. After which, she was released to spend another 6 weeks in at-home supervised care with Dad, the undiagnosed alcoholic, as her primary, whereas in a native village, the entire population would have cared for her, equally and compassionately around the clock. And they're the primitives. Don't get me started. At which point, Mom came home from Western Psychiatric, assuming they'd pumped her full of Miltowns until she was thoroughly numb and told her to take up needlepoint. At the time on treatment protocol priority lists, housewives were one step above livestock. You can sense the unspoken shame filling that household like a slow leak from a toxic well. The mother passed 5 years ago. Although patient made an attempt to break away and start life on her own in Spokane, it proved unsuccessful, and when she felt herself sliding, she returned home to live with her father again. The manic side is manifesting in the daughter now, too, a hasty, impulsive marriage which all too soon resulted in the wound to the eye, by which point patient was already in the grip of a mania about silent drape runners, in which she spends every waking moment trying to design and build the perfect prototype. She shared some of her drawings for it with me. It's a whole portfolio, really, and she's quite skilled, as she's constantly revising them. This is a new decompensation on me, but then each one is like a snowflake, isn't it? Come to think of it, what better way to deny and conceal the shame you feel is all around you than by silently covering it up? Not unlike the way she's now pulled the curtain closed on her left cerebral optic pathway. Proposed treatment plan and prognosis. This could take a while. We're going to start with nature walks, silent meditation, lots of peace and quiet, massage, maybe some Rolfing to release the patterns locked into her fascia. A lot of time looking at trees, listening to the wind. Wean her off the pain meds and the drape runners and engage in gentle, mythical, metaphorical truth-telling with the hope that eventually she'll be ready to probe the underlying pain. Final thought. A regret, really. Patient would have been a perfect candidate to test my new optical integration system. Glasses with one red polarized to test my new optical integration system. Glasses with one red polarized lens for the right eye and one blue polarized lens for the left. My working theory being that the red spectrum slightly suppresses activity in the left or logical hemisphere, while the blue spectrum does the same in the spatial, intuitive side of the brain. And that when worn together, although it does tend to give reality a slightly purple tint, the patient tends to experience increased integration between the two spheres by increasing activity within the corpus callosum and encouraging the two sides to work together. They work for me, but that's preaching to the choir. She would have been a perfect candidate for testing. It really is a shame she lost the eye.
6. Andrew Packard Revisited. Again. We now return to the second installment of the Andrew Packard saga, also found in the bookhouse.
1. Agent Cooper's investigation into the cold Packard case continues. T.P.
The Andrew Packard Case. Chapter 2. March 15, 1989. Andrew Packard did not die in the explosion at his boathouse. Josie's plot, with Hank as her henchman, failed. Andrew had either been tipped off or sensed Josie was about to do him in and left the boathouse that day undetected, before the explosion. Extensive planning on his part preceded this. Since we know human remains were found at the scene, a body was clearly in the boat at the time of the blast. One has to surmise that role was played by a bum or drifter, whom Andrew drugged or killed and stashed in the boat the night before. Someone who wouldn't be missed. Andrew got all of it dead right. So how exactly did he die the second time? Assume Andrew got away clean and went into hiding. Maybe he didn't know exactly who'd planted the bomb, although hard to imagine he had a better suspect in mind than Josie. But from then on, he stayed a step ahead of her. Assume he found out about her plot beforehand, giving him plenty of time to set up his escape and hide enough cash to pull off a disappearing act. Once he realized he'd fleeced both Josie and the police, he created a new identity and traveled back to Hong Kong to dig up the truth about Josie that he'd missed the first time. He soon fingered his old partner, Thomas Eckert, as Josie's accomplice, realizing he'd been played for a patsy by both of them to kill him and take possession of his fortune. Andrew waited 3 years to put his revenge into play and didn't reveal himself until all the players, including Hank when he got out of the pen, were gathered on the stage. The only person he trusted to help pull this off was the one he'd trusted the longest, his sister, Catherine. Once Andrew knew the hit was coming, all the rest was a setup, the accident, the new will, to catch Josie. Once Andrew split the scene, Catherine became his eyes and ears. Josie was patient, playing a long game. She waited almost 2 years to make her move. Josie was smart as a snake. But once his mind got clear about who she really was, Andrew was smarter. And as soon as Josie tried to sell the mill and tens of thousands of adjoining Ghostwood Forest acreage to Ben Horn for a speculative real estate venture, behind Catherine's and Josie's partner Eckert's back, Andrew showed up in town again. Andrew informs Josie that since he's obviously not dead, the mill is no longer hers. So there's no sale. They toy with Josie for a while, brother and sister, punishing and humiliating her, treating her as a servant. They were like that, the two of them, the way they looked at people, like kids burning ants with a magnifying glass. Then Andrew sends word to Eckert about where he can find Josie, letting him know how Josie has played him as well. Eckert first sends an emissary to take her out, but Josie shoots that man in Seattle. After that, she tries to kill an FBI agent who is on to her. Yours truly. With the same weapon.
3. Verified. During the Palmer investigation, a previously unidentified assailant shot Cooper in his room at the Great Northern Hotel. His notes reveal that Cooper, expecting the assault, was wearing a Kevlar vest that saved his life. TP.
Then the noose begins to tighten. Andrew plays both ends against the middle. He tells Josie he knows she only tried to kill him because Eckert forced her to. He warns her the law is about to catch up with her. For that and all her other crimes. That much, at least, was true.
4. This is the end of the typewritten material. What follows is handwritten on the same page, TP.
I was there, Coop. Andrew told her he forgave her, because he couldn't help himself. He still loved her, and that Eckert was coming to take her away and help her escape the law, with his blessings. Maybe she believed him. I don't know. Then Eckert showed up, and Andrew told him that Josie warned him about the attempt on his life years earlier, betraying Eckert. Like that was the only reason he'd survived in the first place. Josie sleeps with Eckert, then shoots him in his room at the Great Northern. I got there moments later. Josie swore she shot him in self-defense, and like always, I believed her. Then she just died. Like her heart failed, broken to pieces by all the lies she'd kept living for so long, right there in my arms. Most of her died a long time ago. She already felt like a ghost. Thank you, Coop. It's better to know than not to know. That's what you always said, right? Someday, I'll probably agree with you.
5. I've determined there's a 96% probability this is the handwriting of Sheriff Truman. Given how shaky it appears, my guess would be that he was drinking heavily at the time, which accounts for the 4% disparity. Truman must have written it after finding these chapters in the bookhouse, just as Cooper had apparently intended him to do. Probably after Cooper left town, by the way. The following excerpt from the coroner's report could have been added by either Truman or the archivist. TP.
Calhoun Memorial Hospital, autopsy report, 1989-03-11-01. Packard, Josie. On the morning of March 11, 1989, an autopsy was completed on the body of Josie Packard. Visible injuries, none. Internal injuries, none. Cause of death, unknown. Anatomical summary. No visible wounds or injuries. Internal organs appear healthy and functional. No drugs or alcohol in stomach or bloodstream. Curious anomaly. Body weighs much less, at least 25 pounds, than physical appearance would indicate. I have no explanation for this. Dr. Dan Hayward.
Archivist's note. Days after his death, an associate of Eckhart showed up in Twin Peaks and made arrangements to transport both Eckhart's and Josie's bodies back for burial in Hong Kong. Neither Andrew Packard nor anyone else objected to the arrangement. The associate also left a gift with Catherine, one that Eckhart apparently wanted her and Andrew to have. An elaborate Chinese puzzle box. Inside that box they found another identical but smaller box, and inside that one an even smaller steel box. When Andrew, Catherine, and Pete succeeded in opening that one, they found a key to a safe deposit box at the Twin Peaks Savings and Loan. Eckhart had visited the bank and left something there for them. Pete and Andrew went to the bank the following morning together to check it out. 7. Recent developments. Twin Peaks Post.
1. Kind of quaint, isn't it? How news was still being disseminated in print during these last days before the internet. If it weren't for all the murders and explosions and dizzying double crosses, I'd be tempted to say it seemed like a more innocent time. TP.
March 28, 1989.
Explosion at Bank. 3 dead, 1 injured. By Cyril Pons, staff reporter. A deadly explosion ripped through the downtown offices of the Twin Peaks Savings and Loan at 9:25 this morning. Details are still coming in, and police, fire, and rescue crews remained on the scene as this edition went to press. Our staff reporters are still on the scene as well, gathering facts, and the bank has yet to issue an official statement. In speaking with law enforcement and the few witnesses we've been able to locate, here is what we know. The blast appeared to have occurred in the bank's basement, in the area of the vault and the safe deposit box room. The most extensive structural damage was confined to this lower level of the building, but all of the windows on the main floor were blown out, causing chaos, but no serious injuries, thankfully, on Main Street. A shower of money was also blown out into the street, which added to the confusion. At approximately 9:15 this morning, Twin Peaks high school senior Audrey Horn, 18, daughter of prominent local businessman Benjamin Horn, entered the bank for reasons that are still unknown. At approximately 9:20, a witness at the bakery across the street noticed two men enter the building. One she recognized as Pete Martell, 52, manager of the Packard Mill. The second man, who she described as older, silver-haired, and wearing a suit, she did not recognize. The cashier on duty upstairs, Mrs. Dorothy Doak, 49, who was severely shaken up by the incident but not injured, was taken to the hospital for observation and was not available for comment. After the blast, Miss Horn was found unconscious but alive in the rubble of the basement. She has been transported to the ICU at Calhoun Memorial Hospital, where she is listed in critical condition. Another witness reported that when she was carried out to the ambulance on a stretcher, they noticed a pair of handcuffs attached to one of her wrists. A first responder later confirmed to this reporter that Miss Horn had been found near the open vault door, but that it may have shielded her at least partially from the explosion. He also confirmed that Miss Horn may have been intentionally shielded by one of the victims in the blast, Pete Martell, who was found lying on top of her. Mr. Martell was pronounced dead at the scene. He is survived by his wife, Catherine Martell. The second victim, whose body we're told was found on the stairs to the first floor, was the bank's longtime assistant manager, Delbert Mibler, 79. A beloved presence in our downtown community and the grandson of one of the bank's founding partners back in 1906, Mr. Mibler was believed to be less than 1 week away from officially retiring after 58 years at his family's institution. The third victim, who has yet to be identified and was apparently the closest person to the actual blast, is believed to be the silver-haired man who was seen earlier entering the bank with Mr. Martell. By mid-morning, a rumor was circulating through the crowd outside that this man might have been Andrew Packard, who a few people swear they have seen around the Great Northern during the last few weeks, despite the well-known fact that Mr. Packard perished in an explosion in the boathouse of his estate on Black Lake several years ago. Another rumor making the rounds is that several news organizations received word from an unknown source earlier this morning that something big was going to happen at the bank today. News crews were actually on their way there when the explosion occurred. The Post will publish a second special edition this evening to bring you all additional details as they are made available.
Archivist's note. That bomb at the bank provided a punctuation mark to the end of the final sentence of the final chapter of the Packards' prominence in Twin Peaks. Thomas Eckhart played the last card in their game after all. Authorities never did publicly identify the third victim, who died at the bank. So Andrew Packard rose from his grave only to be sent hurtling back there by a second explosion. Given that Cooper had figured this all out and passed the information on to Truman, it must have been decided somewhere in the corridors of power that some truths were simply too inconvenient to reveal. This time Andrew stayed dead. The explosion was explained away as the tragic outcome of a gas leak from an antiquated boiler meeting an opportunistic spark. The Packard Mill and all its properties passed back into the sole possession of Catherine Martell, the grieving sister, and her grief was genuine, make no mistake about that. Survivors bear the brunt of tragedy, especially if they had a hand in creating it. She was the only resident of Blue Pine Lodge now, and with no living heirs or relations, Catherine became a recluse. She never spoke or wrote about what had happened, so one question remains unanswered. Who exactly was she grieving for? All of them, perhaps. Brother Andrew, certainly. Husband Pete, for all his shortcomings, at least in her eyes, probably. Maybe even Josie, the worthy opponent who had tested her like no other.
2. As the last of the old-growth forests were harvested, the lumber industry around Twin Peaks had been declining for years. Soon after, Catherine abruptly closed the Packard Mill, the town's largest employer throughout the 20th century, after a fire strangely gutted its central facilities. As the town's largest employer, the mill's closing dealt a devastating blow to the local economy. A few weeks after the fire, Catherine sold the mill and its associated properties to her former paramour, Benjamin Horn, and his investors in the Ghostwood development, the plan he'd been pursuing for years.
Given her amorality and cold contempt toward people, it's difficult to view Catherine Packard as a sympathetic figure. She was, however, tragic in the tradition of Greek drama, as one highborn with many gifts who falls victim to her own hubris.
Twin Peaks Registrar, P.O. Box 45I, Twin Peaks, Washington 98065. Assignment of contract, sale of real estate. Know all men by these presents that Benjamin Joseph Horn of Twin Peaks, Washington, for and in consideration of the sums of $33 million and no dollars lawful money of the United States to Catherine Martell, paid by Twin Peaks Bank of Twin Peaks, country of United States, State of Washington, do by these presents sell, transfer, assign, and set over unto the said contract for the sale of certain real estate described as follows of wit. The Packard Mill, including but not limited to IT's Associated Properties, FL number 3550537, Twin Peaks County. Made and recorded on the 23rd day of March 1989 in book SB number 333927, page 1 of 5, in the office of the county recorded of said county in which said contract was made and executed by Honorable M.J. Caffey, Esquire. County of Timber Lull, State of Washington, and bears date the 23rd day of March, 1989. Signed, Mary Jo Plutnik, Notary Public, March 23rd, 1989, Twin Peaks, Washington. The role of genuinely tragic victim here is reserved for 18-year-old Audrey Horn. The following note was left for Ben Horn at the front desk of the Great Northern Hotel on the morning of the explosion at the bank.
3. Based on what it cost him personally, the price Horn paid for the mill was a lot higher than the amount on the check. T.P.
Twin Peaks, the Great Northern Hotel, Washington. Dear Daddy, I know you think I've been a selfish little bitch most of my life, and you're absolutely right. I've been really mean to people and treated them very badly, and thought only about myself. I've been spoiled rotten. I'm not blaming anyone for that anymore, and it's about time I take responsibility for my actions. So, I'm making amends as of now, from this day forward. And I'm starting with this letter. I can no longer stand by and watch as you destroy the heart of our town with your plan to close the mill and turn all of our beautiful forests into tacky neighborhoods and shopping centers, and whatever else you and your greedy friends are planning. Maybe even a prison, I'm hearing. Daddy, there is more to life than money. But I know there's no point in talking about it because you won't listen to me anymore. I won't tell you how I found out what you're planning, because it doesn't really matter. And no matter what you may think, it's not too late to stop all this madness and do the right thing. So I'm going to try and stop you the only way I know how, by calling public attention to your secret plans. I believe that's the only way you will come to your senses about how wrong all this is and what a betrayal it would be to the people of our community. I intend to give copies of your plans to the newspaper. and I will be talking to people, probably news reporters and such, about all of this very, very soon. You'll see. I hope you understand that none of this is done out of hate. I also hope someday you'll realize I'm taking this step because of how much I love you, with the hope that it will help you become the man I know you can be, the man I believe you once were, the one I love and admire more than any other. With all my heart, Audrey.
Archivist's note. Audrey's plan that morning apparently was to handcuff herself to the bars of the bank vault, where her father kept a lot of his money, after sending notes to local news organizations that they could find her there.
4. This anonymous tip must have been the source of the rumor mentioned in the Post article that something big was about to happen at the bank. TP.
In the weeks leading up to the accident, Audrey had been reading about social protest and civil disobedience. She brought with her to the bank copies of information she'd discovered about her father's plans that she intended to share with the news sources. Her luck was as bad that day as her intentions were good. Those copies were destroyed in the explosion before anyone could see them. But her father did receive her note at the hotel. Too late to prevent her from being hurt, as it turned out, but in time to make him the only person in town who knew what his daughter was doing there that day. Ben Horn never revealed the existence of that note or commented on it to anyone. Those who saw him at his daughter's bedside in the hospital afterward described a man broken in half with grief and, we can now also surmise, personal guilt. Ben Horn experienced no overnight conversion, however. As noted, he went ahead with the purchase of the mill and ghostwood from Catherine. But something did change in the man at that point. In the months leading up to the explosion, Ben watched the calamity that befell the family of his friend and lawyer, Leland Palmer, with shock and horror. The murder of their daughter, Laura, unhinged the entire community. In its aftermath, Ben went through something of a mental break himself.
Dr. Lawrence Jacoby, 3-22-89, 2 p.m., Benjamin Horn, married. Date of birth, August 4th, 1940. Male, 49. 6 foot, 1 inch, 174 pounds. Patient has been recently under my care at his place of employment, the Great Northern. Daily house calls for the last week. I've insisted that he be confined to his quarters there, with no visits home that might counter the treatment plan. Patient is laboring under an elaborate delusion that he's traveled back in time to the Civil War. He is living inside the persona of a Southern general, attempting to rewrite history by leading his side to victory. This seems to me an unconscious compensation, as he's assumed the side with the untenable moral position, attempting to alter or erase his own personal and questionable recent behavioral history. I've enlisted the help of his family and a few employees to enable the fantasy, but also gently direct him to the truth of the war's actual conclusion. If we are able to guide Ben to enact the actual surrender at Appomattox, I believe we can bring him out of the delusion and onto a healing path.
5. Verified. According to Jacoby's subsequent patient files, Ben Horn did surrender at Appomattox and find his way back to health. TP.
But the larger question remained. Would the injury to Ben's daughter serve as a further wake-up call to make him more the man his daughter longed for him to be? She'd nearly died delivering that message to him, and her life hung in the balance. Only time would tell if he listened.
6. Chronologically speaking, this is one of the latest events that the archivist references in the dossier. One possible theory is that something may have happened to our correspondent soon after this point, making efforts to discover what that might have been. TP.
8. Renault and Jennings. Two final loose ends tie up this section. Jean Renault, the Canadian criminal kingpin, was gunned down in an FBI shootout on American soil outside of Twin Peaks, during an FBI-DEA joint sting operation involving narcotics that also involved local thug Hank Jennings. Agent Cooper himself took Renault out while under fire himself.
1. Verified, a joint FBI-DEA operation, TP.
Hank Jennings was then pulled in for parole violations that, in addition to international drug trafficking, also included assault and attempted murder. He pleaded guilty again and went off to serve a 25-year stretch in the state pen at Walla Walla.
2. 3 years later, by which time the archivist had stopped writing, I can confirm that Hank Jennings was fatally knifed in the prison weight room by a hardcore lifer who turned out to be a distant cousin of the Renault family. As we say in law enforcement and Sunday school, what goes around comes around. Jennings, to clear his conscience, issued a deathbed confession to all his various crimes, starting with the football game fix, up through and including his role in the attempted murder of Andrew Packard, and ending with the message shown here, which was sent from prison after his death. TP.
To my former friends and my former wife, Norma, you all tried to help me so many times and get me back onto the way of what's good and right. I'm so ashamed to admit that I betrayed you all so many times. I knew better. I knew I was doing wrong and couldn't help myself. No excuses. I have nothing left to give but to say how sorry I am for any hurt or sorrow I have ever caused you. I can't even ask for your forgiveness because I don't deserve it. It's too late now. I loved you all, in my own way, as best I could. But it wasn't enough. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Hank.
3. After signing this note, according to prison sources, the last of the Jennings clan of Twin Peaks drew his final breath. TP.
Archivist note. Much can be learned in unexpected places. The library at the bookhouse is unique in my experience as an invaluable local resource. This special shelf contains the members' favorite tomes. Good literature is a mirror through which we see ourselves more clearly. And it's clear to see that the people of Twin Peaks have experienced many a twisting turn of fate. It's time to go back and pick up the trail of Douglas Milford, to learn how he moved forward from the moment we last left him, 1949, into the world and town of today. The coming of what? We know that after Milford presented his report on the Twin Peaks incident to Project Sign, the estimate of the situation that they sent to the Air Force top brass was roundly rejected. Soon afterwards, Sign turned into Project Grudge, and debunking UFOs became the order of the day. The first case assigned to Major Milford for Grudge was mind-altering. It came to him from an oblique angle, and his work on it took place over a 3-year period, at the end of which the polar axis of UFO investigation would shift yet again, radically changing the focus of his work. The case began when this letter arrived at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in November 1949.
1. This appears authentic, as does the signature, but I can find no other existing copy of this letter or the transcript that follows it in official files. TP.
Office of the Honorable Richard M. Nixon, 12th District of California, House of Representatives. Personal and confidential. November 12, 1949. Dear General Twining, members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff suggested I write to you directly regarding the following matter. In my ongoing capacity as a member of the House Un-American Activities, HUAC, I am charged with the investigation of organizations or individuals, often within our government itself, who may represent a hidden menace to the security of our nation and our way of life. On occasion, testimony is offered to me in closed session that warns of a grave threat at such a high level of potential risk that its investigation requires extraordinary levels of discretion and sensitivity. As you will find within the body of the testimony, aspects of this case appear to fall squarely within your charter. If I may be so bold to suggest, only your most dependable and experienced officers should be entrusted with this. The enclosed transcript contains unsolicited information offered to me recently by a former Navy intelligence officer. It describes a scandalous and corrupt personality, close to the heart of an organization that is absolutely vital to the security of the American military. Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, founded several years ago, has become our nation's most important research and development facility for rocket science. I believe you will agree with me that these frankly shocking allegations are potentially explosive and demand immediate inquiry. Please contact me at your earliest convenience after you've had a chance to review the following material. Very sincerely yours, Richard M. Nixon. Congressman Richard M. Nixon and, name redacted, reference number 49-0351, date 10-17-49, transcribed from interview conducted at the Congressman's Washington office, 10-17-49. Congressman Nixon. Okay, the tape is rolling now. Please state your name.
Lafayette Ronald Hubbard, Lieutenant, Navy Intelligence, born Tilden, Nebraska, age 38.
Are you still on active duty, Lieutenant?
I was mustered out after the war, sir. I still hold my commission. I prefer to go by Ron, by the way.
Thank you, Ron. I see here that you were discharged for medical reasons, is that correct?
Yes, sir. During my years as a commander of two anti-submarine vessels in the Pacific Theater, I suffered from, among other ailments related to the stress of combat, ulcers, conjunctivitis, bursitis, various eye problems, and something wrong with my feet.
And I understand you're here to tell us something about your experiences just after the war. Is that correct, Ron?
Yes, sir. Since my war service, I have pursued a career as a writer. Fiction, science fiction, mostly short stories for magazines and a few novels for small publishing firms. I don't know if you'd be familiar with...
I'm not, sorry. Please go on.
Two, as unlikely as it sounds, this appears to be the same L. Ron Hubbard, a prolific pulp fiction author who a short time later was responsible for the founding of the controversial Religion of Scientology, TP.
While pursuing my writing career, living in Los Angeles at the time, this was August 1945, acquaintances of mine, some of them fellow writers, introduced me to a group of people living in Pasadena. This social circle revolved around a man named Marvel John Whiteside Parsons, who went by the name of Jack.
Would this be the chemist Jack Parsons who co-founded Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena?
The very same, sir.
Three. Verified that Jack Parsons, a noted chemist and engineer, was indeed one of the founders of JPL. During the 30s and early 40s, he was instrumental in the development of rocket fuel science, which led directly to its implementation by the military during World War II. TP.
I am somewhat familiar with his role at JPL, yes.
Good. Well, after we were introduced, Jack and I became friendly. As I was going through some financial difficulties at the time, he generously invited me to stay at his house in Pasadena. I say house, but it was a mansion, really, known locally as, a bit of a pun, the Parsonage.
Yes, I see.
A number of people lived at the house there, you see, so this invitation was nothing out of the ordinary. But what I learned soon after moving in was that things at the Parsonage were not as they seemed.
In what way?
I discovered that Parsons, for the better part of a decade, had been consorting with a peculiar cultish and self-styled religion that its adherents called Thelema.
I can't say that I'm familiar with it.
Neither was I, sir. You see, Thelema is patterned after the teachings of Parsons' friend and mentor, the notorious English mystic Aleister Crowley.
I've heard the name.
Well, as a reference point, I have often heard Crowley described as the most evil man in the world.
You have my attention, Lieutenant.
You see, Crowley and Parsons and his followers believe in some very strange things, and they indulge in some extracurricular activities at the parsonage that, frankly, boggle the mind.
For instance?
Openly partaking of various drugs, the practice of free love, and the periodic enactment of bizarre sex magic rituals.
All right there, smack in the middle of Pasadena?
Yes, sir.
Well, did you alert the proper authorities?
The local police have been frequent visitors at the parsonage, yes, sir. Especially on nights when the hijinks go late into the night and disturb the neighbors. But my concern and my reason for being here isn't about disturbing the peace. It's entirely about the threat Mr. Parsons represents to the security of the rocket program at JPL. If I may, I'd like to introduce into evidence a report I've prepared for you on the activities I've observed. Something, I hasten to add, done and offered entirely in the spirit of my duty and obligation as a former naval intelligence officer.
So noted and appreciated, Ron. I'm a Navy man myself and still a proud officer of the reserve. Let it be entered into the record.
U.S. Naval Air Station, Point Magoo, California. Location, Pasadena, California. Field report, Lieutenant L. Ron Hubbard, retired. Top secret. I had little trouble making contact with the subject of my inquiry. Parsons is a naturally gregarious sort, and presided over his personal and professional duchy in Pasadena with the benevolence of a feudal lord. With the war over, he was somewhat removed from the day-to-day operations at JPL. A dreamer by nature and an amateur at heart, Parsons disdained interest in factory work, although he continues to consult with his scientists and engineers who were part of what he called his suicide squad during their freewheeling research on advanced rocket fuels. Back then, Parsons and his team were the only ones in the country working on rockets, and the man possessed an uncanny mastery of identifying and taming the most combustible and dangerous chemicals known to science, producing what he called alchemical elixirs, what we more prosaically call fuel, generated the most powerful, controlled, and sustained explosions the world has ever seen. Parsons today still possesses unshakable faith that the path he blazed over the past 20 years, at a time when the scientific community mocked and dismissed the idea of rocket science as a pipe dream, mere science fiction, will one day result in vehicles capable of taking man to the moon and the stars beyond. Raised by a wealthy Pasadena family who lost their fortune in the Depression, Parsons never received a college degree because of financial hardship, although he briefly attended classes at three top universities. This made him, in effect, a self-taught chemist who from an early age possessed a burning obsession, ignited by an early exposure to authors like Jules Verne and H.G. Wells, to launch objects into space. With the drums of war beating in Europe, armed with little more than chutzpah and youthful enthusiasm, Parsons talked his way into a grant from the California Institute of Technology, Caltech, the foremost scientific academy in the western United States. 7 years downstream from that investment, Jack Parsons' groundbreaking work has resulted in the creation of rockets as science, with, needless to say, limitless ongoing military utility. Genesis to takeoff, a now standard feature for Air Force bombers and fighters, being the most obviously beneficial for which he was directly responsible. One need speak to him only once to realize that Jack Parsons is a true visionary, perhaps even a genius along the lines of past noteworthy scientists who have altered the course of human history. There's also no question in my mind that he is stark raving mad. With the windfall he received from the founding of JPL in 1943, Parsons purchased a mansion on Orange Grove Boulevard in Pasadena, a street known as Millionaire's Row, where he also happened to live growing up. He dubbed his new house the Parsonage, which sounds considerably more ecumenical in name than practice.
4. The house had originally been built by one of Caltech's earlier benefactors, a lumber baron named Arthur Fleming, perhaps coincidentally with high-grade lumber imported from the region around Twin Peaks. TP.
Parsons uses the house as his residence, but it also functions as headquarters for his church, which they call Thelema, but I think is better described as a coven. Parsons' interest in the occult developed after his fascination with rockets. His first contact with the Thelema crowd came in 1939, but in his mind at this point, the two disciplines are intertwined. 3 years later, Parsons became the leader of the West Coast branch, or Lodge, and his immersion only deepened. At Parsons' invitation, I took up residence at the parsonage and soon after attended a Thelema gathering. A strange, incense-laden air of debauchery populated by a motley assemblage of leftists, bohemians, and hangers-on, attended by a cadre of young, attractive JPL secretaries, all of whom swept up in a kind of fever cult. Many of the guests wore colorful, erotic masks, and a few wore elaborate Egyptian costumes or masks with distorted animal faces. Disturbing atonal music played from somewhere and prompted such uninhibited dancing, and by that I don't mean the jitterbug. In some back rooms, I have no doubt, there was rampant drug use. I caught the unmistakable tang of reefer wafting through the upper floor, and I believe the punch they were serving may have been laced with a home-brewed, mind-altering substance, perhaps absinthe. In many of these rooms, not even behind closed doors, sexual hijinks abounded. I'm not a prude, but I've never felt more Episcopalian in my life. For all his accomplishments, Parsons was only 31 years old. A tall, powerfully built, ruggedly handsome man with a Barrymore mustache and the louche air of a Sybarite. Dressed in a flowing robe and fez-like headdress, with an albino python draped around his shoulders, he presided over his guests like a Pied Piper to all their illicit behavior. At one point, I found myself alone in a strange room upstairs with Parsons. The walls were festooned with crossed swords, symbols of the tarot, pagan art. It was furnished only with a skull-shaped altar, what looked like a throne, and an unnerving life-size statue of a bestial satyr, which Parsons told me is the demigod Pan. Parsons is fond of stomping his feet while reciting a poem called Ode to Pan during his test launches. I activated the small tradecraft tape recorder I always carry with me and took the opportunity to record and later transcribe without his knowledge the following conversation. All those photos on the wall, is that who I think it is?
Yes, Aleister Crowley, the Beast, my friend and teacher.
He died recently, didn't he?
Yes, he shed his body just last year.
Well, he was a heroin addict, wasn't he? That might have something to do with it.
Oh, he didn't need drugs. He was drugs.
5. Crowley was in fact a notorious drug addict who wore himself out at 72 after decades of rampant abuse of every indulgence ever cataloged by man. TP.
I mean, look around you. It's all Thelema, you know? That was his lasting legacy for us, his crowning achievement, and it will live forever.
Thelema?
6. Thelema is literally the Greek word for will or intention. Making it the centerpiece of an anti-Christian religion seems to have first been done in a 16th century satirical novel by Rabelais and was later appropriated by Crowley for his own purposes, which were decidedly not satirical. But Crowley took credit for inventing the whole Thelema business after a series of mystical experiences in Egypt, which led to his writing the tenets of his new religion while in a kind of trance state, claiming he received them from a higher power, like opium or hashish, for instance. A lot of it seems inspired, i.e. lifted, from the Book of Revelation, which also strikes me as impenetrable gobbledygook. On the one hand, Crowley's kind of fascinating. Upper-crust Englishman, iconoclast, mountain climber, author, first Westerner to spend time studying with lamas in Tibet. But on the other hand, he's like a sick, perverted Bond villain. I mean, they didn't call him the most evil person in the world for nothing. TP.
The word of the law is Thelema. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. Love is the law, love under will. Do you see? The power of the will is all, but without eros or agape, love and sex joined together, will is nothing but hollow patriarchal power, without direction or force. What he taught us is that both forces must exist in balance. In order to stand beside God, you have to first reject the idea of God. Then, and only then, will you come to realize that you are God. Every man and woman is a star.
I see.
Rockets and magic. Ask yourself, what do they share? They're about transcending all limits, acts of rebellion against the limits of gravity and inertia and the limits of human existence. We will only be held down, earthbound, for so long. Two sides of the same coin. Alchemy isn't only about chemistry or turning base metals to gold. The medieval philosophers and alchemists knew this. Even Isaac Newton knew it, but their knowledge was lost until Crowley brought it back. You see, alchemy actually speaks to internal processes and a radical revolution in our spiritual development, transforming the base metal of primitive man to the gold of an enlightened soul. Rockets and magic are both about breaking through the animal boundaries of space and time that hold us back from realizing our potential. Either, maybe both, will someday take us to the moon and the stars beyond. I truly believe that. Magic is just the name we've always given to things we don't yet understand. The magician longs to see.
Excuse me, what's that?
I've often felt there were spirits in this wood. You'll have to excuse me. I must attend to my other guests.
I left the parsonage near midnight. The party was just getting started. People were jumping over a bonfire out by a pergola. Some of them were naked. That was a Thursday night, by the way. Presumably, all these people were expected to show up for work in the morning. The next day at JPL, where Parsons himself did not show up for work, I spoke with scientists and administrators who had not been at the party. They expressed serious concern that Parsons was on the verge of going off the rails. They're underestimating the situation. I believe he slid off the rails into an amoral swamp years ago. His scientific mind may be as sharp as ever, but the consensus is that what was once tolerated as personal eccentricity has overwhelmed his native brilliance. To my eyes, he now seems about as stable as a souffle.
Archivist note. The report offers no explanation about why Hubbard waited so long to report this to authorities. It may have something to do with the fact that in the interim, Ron Hubbard conned Jack Parsons out of his life savings and ran off to Florida with Parsons' hot young girlfriend, where they used the money they snookered from him to buy a yacht.
7. Confirmed. Hubbard soon married Sarah Betty Northrup before officially divorcing his first wife, adding polygamy to his checkered resume. In 1950, he published his greatest success, Dianetics, the book that became the basis of his own religion, one that clearly borrowed multiple ideas and themes from Thelema. T.P.
During those post-war years, JPL grew into a multi-million-dollar business, occupying a central role in the aerospace industry and the emerging military-industrial complex. As his company took off, Parsons doubled down on his involvement in occult mumbo-jumbo and came under suspicion for, possibly, selling secrets of America's rocket program to a foreign government. Soon after these charges came to light, although he was ultimately acquitted, JPL terminated its official relationship with Parsons. With his income gone and his professional reputation damaged, he was forced to sell the parsonage. Struggling financially, he sued Hubbard to try to get his money back. While working as a consultant on a military missile program, when it came time to renew his national security clearance. Which is why, soon after the foregoing report from Congressman Nixon landed on Major Doug Milford's desk, Project Grudge dispatched him to Pasadena to investigate. This is the report he soon filed in response.
Reclassified EO-12356, Section 3.3, NLK-85151, NARA date redacted, top secret. Regarding Project Grudge 49-12-0037. Pasadena, California, December 3rd, 1949. Top secret. Field report, Major Douglas Milford. Subject, Jack Parsons. I found Jack Parsons living in an apartment near the beach. in meager circumstances, trying to scrape together a living from a variety of consulting and manufacturing jobs. I approached him using cover as a journalist for a left-wing magazine, and he agreed to meet me for an article I told him I was writing about what really happened to him at JPL. He welcomed the opportunity to, as he put it, set the record straight. He appeared fleshy and downtrodden, and his handsome features had started to corrode. His personal life had taken a recent turn, and that was where, in a Manhattan Beach coffee shop, our conversation began. I heard you just got married, Jack. Congratulations.
I wish it were that simple, but thank you.
If you don't mind my asking, what's happened to your ex?
Helen?
I thought her name was Sarah.
Oh, you mean Betty. Sarah's middle name is Elizabeth. That's what she goes by, Betty. No, I was never married to Betty. She's Helen's younger sister, half-sister. Helen was my first wife, but she's married to someone else now, too.
Wow. Sounds complicated.
It is. And Betty just got married. To him.
Him?
Hubbard. Ron Hubbard. He was part of our crowd in Pasadena, showed up after the war. Navy man, intelligence, a hack science fiction writer. Maybe you've heard the name.
Can't say I have.
People wandered in and out of that house all the time. When Ron showed up with his war stories and his wit and his polymath brilliance, I thought I'd found a boon companion. Betty hated him on sight. That's when I knew she and I were in trouble.
Hmm. How so?
Oh, within weeks they were together. Ron just drew her to him like he had her under a spell. So she left me. But he was such a friend, and we weren't, you know, any of us focused on bourgeois shit like monogamy, so I still thought of him as my friend. We were as close as could be. I thought he understood me better than anyone I'd ever met.
Was he a member of your church as well?
Oh, yeah. He dove right in. Relentless. He wanted to know everything about it. We worked together tirelessly for 2 years on a really important project.
Are you talking about rockets or magic?
See, these were things Crowley had written about, a ritual that he'd attempted in Europe. Important work, but no one had ever tried it over here.
A ritual? And Hubbard was helping you with this?
We saw things that maybe men aren't supposed to see.
Where was this?
Out in the desert. The desert's a perfect medium for summoning an empty canvas, a beaker into which, under certain circumstances and with fearless rigor, you can create an elixir that will call forth, call them what you will, messengers of the gods.
Wow. What does that look like?
Oh, they assume many forms. The grays, for instance. You know, Zeta Reticulans.
8. Zeta Reticuli is a binary star system in the constellation of Reticulum, visible to the naked eye in the southern hemisphere, often cited in UFO literature as the home to a race of small gray aliens who allegedly visit Earth. TP.
The tall ones now, the Nordic types, they're different, more benign. Some say they've always been here. Supposedly they come from the Dog Star.
The Dog Star?
Sirius.
Yes, I'm serious.
9. I believe Milford missed Parsons' reference here to Sirius, a star in the relatively nearby constellation Canis Major, or Big Dog, often referred to in UFO lore as another possible source of visiting alien life. This recalls the two competing races of aliens mentioned earlier in the Ray Palmer magazine stories. TP.
Ever been to Roswell?
Roswell, New Mexico. As a matter of fact, I have.
We were near there in the desert, a place they call Jornada del Muerto.
That's near White Sands, isn't it?
Right. It means Journey of the Dead Man. Isn't that beautiful? The way we all move through our lives, eyes closed, head down, shuffling along, dead before our time, journeying toward the grave.
That's where they tested the bomb.
Yes. Such a fertile ground for the working.
Pardon? What's the working?
The ritual. The working of Babylon, calling forth the elemental.
Could you elaborate on that, Jack? Car horn blares. I look outside where an old Buick Roadster convertible is pulled up. A striking technicolor redhead is behind the wheel. Jack snaps back to himself out of his dreamy reverie, looks at his watch, and smiles.
Sorry, that's the wife. We're supposed to hit the flea market today. Anyway, Hubbard, yeah. He really knew how to stick in the knife and twist it.
We shake hands, and after he leaves, I drive to Pasadena. I'd arranged to meet with one of Parson's former colleagues, a longtime scientific associate, calm, cerebral, and sober as a judge. I told him the truth, that I was conducting a confidential military investigation, and he agreed to speak only on the condition of anonymity. I, of course, agreed. He had worked with Parsons from the mid-1930s as part of his suicide squad, and still had great affection for him. So he had seen changes diminish the man he knew as well as anyone. He took me into the Arroyo Seco near the JPL labs. The Arroyo Seco is a forbidding and desolate 25-mile-long dry river canyon, lined with rocks and immense boulders washed down over geologic eons from the San Gabriel Mountains that tower above the city. This desolate patch is where Parsons and company used to test their fuels and shoot off rockets in their halcyon days. During the sporadic monsoonal rains peculiar to the region, the Arroyo Seco, dry stream in Spanish, named by the Spanish explorer Gaspar de Portola in the late 18th century, becomes a raging torrent. As the city of Pasadena grew down below, a dam was built there in 1920 where a waterfall rumbles during the rains to contain the seasonal floods. They call this spot the Devil's Gate, named for a rock outcropping at its base that many believe resembles the face of a devil. I can confirm that it does. But the name goes back farther than the Army Corps of Engineers. The Tongva Indians, who lived in the area for centuries, called this spot the Hell Gate because they believed it was literally a portal to the underworld.
10. In a letter, I found that Aleister Crowley wrote to Parsons after he assumed leadership of Thelema's Pasadena Lodge. He tells Parsons that he had researched Hellgate. He doesn't specify how, and concluded that it was one of seven gateways on the planet to hell, and encouraged him to make use of it. Make of that what you will. TP.
His colleague told me that Parsons used this area for his personal exploration of what he called the explosive sciences of both the literal and metaphorical varieties, because he believed they would open up the gate.
11. I have to concede that even for the ravings of a madman, that's a little ominous. TP.
So this is also where, after founding JPL, Parsons first began enacting his bizarre Thelema rituals. His associate told me, strictly off the record, those rituals were an attempt to summon into human form the spirit of a figure central to the Thelema pantheon, the goddess Babylon, known as the Mother of Abominations.
12. The goddess Babylon is a reference to a figure borrowed and reinterpreted by Crowley from the Book of Revelation, the odd appendage to the New Testament that was added hundreds of years after the Bible's traditional structure had been widely adopted. It is apocalyptic in both rhetoric and content, although an ongoing debate about whether it was intended as a literal or metaphorical document continues to this day. TP.
I asked him what possible good could come of Parsons doing something that sounds like provoking the end of the world. Looking pale and uneasy, frequently glancing at the dark mouth of a tunnel under the Devil Rock, the man told me he had no idea what Jack had in mind, but that it took two people to enact the ritual. He said that a friend of Jack's named Ron Hubbard had been his key collaborator in these weird rites. He described Hubbard as a science fiction writer who had drifted into Parsons' orbit. The man I was speaking with had immediately made Hubbard for a con man who didn't believe any of Jack's supernatural hoo-ha, but Parsons wouldn't listen to his or anyone else's concerns about Hubbard. He also recalled a conversation in which Hubbard asserted that the best and surest way to make a fortune in America, aside from bilking your friends, I guess, was to start a religion. Within a year of worming his way into Parsons' confidence, Hubbard had conned him out of $20,000 and his girlfriend Betty, his wife Helen's younger sister, for whom he'd left Helen in 1945. After heading east, Hubbard brazenly used Parsons' money to buy a yacht that he lived on in Miami with Betty. When Parsons threatened legal action to get his money back, Hubbard threatened to publicly expose Parsons' relationship with Betty, who had been underage, 17, at the time she and Parsons became involved.
13. The timing of which could explain Hubbard's sudden urge to testify to Congressman Nixon, T.P.
Archivist note. When he briefly became respectable after publishing his best-selling Dianetics in 1950, Hubbard claimed he had only infiltrated what he called Parsons' sex cult on assignment from military intelligence as an undercover officer. This claim is utterly without foundation. Hubbard was infamous within the intelligence community, who were eager to see him discharged in 1945 as a braggart, liar, and opportunistic sociopath who made Jack Parsons, in all his crackpot glory, look like a Cub Scout. It's also clear that after his close study of the Thelema religion, many of its tenets became central parts of the work Hubbard is best known for.
14. After reviewing Hubbard's oeuvre, I can go further than that. His origin story of ancient aliens, beings he called Thetans, colonizing Earth in deep underground cities beneath volcanoes, seems to owe a lot to Richard Shaver's wild stories of the subterranean Lemurians. T.P.
I asked his former associate if he thought that Parsons believed that any of his black magic rituals had worked.
Well, he said quietly, a week after that one, he met the woman he's married to now, right after he came back from one of those trips to the desert, just before Hubbard ran off with Betty and most of his dough. She was actually waiting at his front door. I realized I had seen the woman he then described to me behind the wheel of the Buick at the coffee shop. She is apparently now Parsons' lawfully wedded second wife.
15. Marjorie Cameron, Parsons' second wife, T.P.
I asked the man if he knew anything about Parsons conducting a ritual in the New Mexico desert. He looked at me sharply and asked how I knew that. I said that Parsons had told me about it himself that morning at the coffee shop, something called the working. The man paused to collect himself and said that Parsons had also told him something like that had taken place. An effort to open a second gate that they'd found in the desert in order to bring across an entity he called the Moonchild. Moonchild is both the title and subject of a 1923 novel by Crowley about a battle between two lodges of black and white magicians over an unborn child who may or may not be the Antichrist. Crowley apparently tried to conduct this ritual himself on numerous occasions earlier in his own life without success, which served as Parsons' inspiration. I asked if he had any idea when that ritual might have taken place. He said he knew exactly when it happened because Parsons had asked him to feed his cats while he was gone. Cross-checking the date, I realized it was the weekend just before the UFO incident in Roswell, part of which I personally witnessed. I looked back at the dam and the tunnel and the eerie face in those rocks. Something uncanny enveloped me. An animalistic fear sliding up my spine, akin to the feeling I had that day in the woods long ago above the Pearl Lakes.
16. He seems to be suggesting that Parsons' ritual somehow opened a gate that resulted in aliens showing up in Roswell. I'm not endorsing this jibber-jabber as fact, but I have done my own research now into the Arroyo Seco. The Native Americans who lived here were in fact wary of the place and did call it the Hellgate, claiming they could hear the devil's laughter in the waterfall. And call it coincidence if you like, but in the decade after Parsons worked his voodoo here, four children went missing in the Arroyo Seco. Two were killed by a construction worker who'd helped build a nearby freeway. He claimed he'd heard voices that compelled him to do it and later took his own life in prison. The third and fourth victims simply disappeared without a trace and were never found. It's late, it's dark, and I am now turning on all the lights in my office. T.P.
Conclusions. As strange as he seems, I confess that I have found Jack Parsons a sympathetic person. He doesn't seem evil to me, just deeply confused. A highly creative man who wants to be liked, but who has sadly lost the ability to filter out the irrational or recognize those who do not wish him well. That being said, it is the considered recommendation of this officer that the renewal of his security clearance be denied, and that all associations with Marvel John Jack Whiteside Parsons by companies or agencies associated with the U.S. military or any other branch of our government be immediately terminated. Major D. Milford. Reproduction from this copy is prohibited unless unclassified. Reclassified E012356, Section 3.3.
Archivist's note. So, once and for all, Parsons lost his place in the science he'd done so much to create. Called to give closed testimony to the House Un-American Activities Committee, where he named a few names, one of them his closest former colleague, Parsons insisted he no longer had any contact with the Church of Thelema, but did offer a spirited defense of his unusual religious beliefs.
Federal Bureau of Investigation. This case originated at, redacted, case number 65-1753. Statement made at Cincinnati, Ohio, date which made 11-22-50, period for which made 11-17-50. Report made by 67C, redacted, John Whiteside Parsons, a.k.a. Jack Parsons. Transcript of closed session testimony, Congressman Richard Nixon. Could you share something of your religious beliefs with us, Mr. Parsons?
The only religion I practice now is the religion of individual freedom. Absolute freedom for the individual to follow his or her own path. No one can do that for any other human being, and every person must arrive at that discovery for themselves. The only restriction I would add to that is that you must do so without interfering with the path of any other person. In other words, do no harm. If there's anything more anti-fascist and anti-communist and more American than that, I'd like to know about it.
So what, then, is the central belief of your religion?
I would say it is this, sir, that everyone has a divine purpose and nature inherent within them. That every person is a divine being, but only through achieving a balance of self-will and love for all living things can one open the door to discover their own divine purpose.
17. Just a theory, but authorities probably leaned on Parsons to name names by threatening to publicly reveal that America's number one rocket man had been using satanic sex magic to try and incarnate the living embodiment of an ancient being called the Moonchild. Parsons' career was ruined, but at least he avoided jail. TP.
Archivist's note. After this report, the House Un-American Activities Committee, the engine driving the paranoid hunt for communists in the post-war U.S. government and military, planted a bullseye on Jack Parsons. Although he never joined the Communist Party, by the time he came under their scrutiny, the FBI had already compiled a 200-page file on him, focusing on the salacious details of his private life. They decided not to prosecute, but denied the renewal of his high-level security clearance, citing his membership in the American Civil Liberties Union. With the permanent revocation of his security clearance, Parsons turned to a life of manual labor to make ends meet, working as a mechanic and hospital orderly. Apparently using bootlegged explosives, he eventually found steadier work as a pyrotechnic consultant on a number of war movies that required numerous explosions. Parsons' downward spiral continued, but another perceived threat he represented to national security prompted Major Doug Milford to make a final visit to Pasadena in 1952.
18. The document on the following page is verified. Parsons' wife later confirmed they were about to permanently relocate to Mexico. TP.
Regarding Project Grudge 52-06-0015. Pasadena, California, June 15, 1952. Top secret. Field report. Major Douglas Milford. Subject: Jack Parsons. I found Jack Parsons living in the old carriage house of the Cruikshank Estate, another Orange Grove Boulevard mansion in Pasadena, just down the street from the former location of the parsonage, which has since been demolished and replaced with apartment buildings, and not far from the mansion he grew up in, also gone now. The Tudor-style carriage house sits far back from the street down a long, winding driveway. It is an overcast and sultry summer day, and the air smells of citrus trees, magnolia trees, and thick jasmine vines that overgrow the timbers. Now 37, Parsons is stockier than I remember, his handsome features sagging and bloated from, I'd hazard to guess, equal parts dissipation and disappointment. I again present myself to him as the same left-wing journalist, following up on the story I wrote 3 years earlier, which he never asks to see. He remembers me from our previous encounter and invites me inside. He seems distracted and anxious. Parsons tells me he lives there with his wife, Marjorie. There are pictures of them on the wall, and I recognize the same striking redhead I saw him with earlier. He tells me he's working for the movies as a pyrotechnics man, which means he's the guy who blows stuff up. World War II movies are all the rage, and someone able to create and control realistic explosions, he is much in demand. The downward trajectory of Parsons' life is reflected in the near squalor of his surroundings. A portion of the main room is given over to a laboratory lined with bottles, beakers, test tubes, and barrels of chemicals and compounds, a few labeled danger, explosives. This area is neither clean nor well maintained, and a strong chemical odor fills the air. There's a small drafting table in the middle of the room where I notice sketches and formulas that seem related to rocket design, which he casually covers when I take an interest in them. When I hear people moving upstairs, he tells me he's taken in two boarders to help with the rent, an actor and a graduate student. I notice he's wearing the same jade green ring I'd seen during my previous visit on his right ring finger. I also notice some discarded hypodermic needles in a trash can. An open box of old printed pamphlets about Thelema sits nearby. A tall, dusty stack of science fiction magazines with lurid covers sags against one wall. A number of strange symbols on